Om Ajnana Timirandasya Ganjana Salakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Mano Vistam Stapitam Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Bandeham Sri Guru Sri Yukta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sagana Raganatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Padijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Sri Visakam Vitam Scha Namarom Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Sri Mate Bhaktivedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gaudavani Pracharane Nivisesya Sunyavadi Pasyachadi Shatane Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sivasadi Gaur Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Nigama Kalpataru Galitam Phalam Sukamukaram Ritadravasam Butam Pibata Bhagavatam Rasamalayam Mahora Hora Sikabu Vibhavukaha Narayanam Namaskritcha Naram Cheva Narottamam Devim Saraswatim Vyasam Tato Jayam Udirayat Nashta prayasu abhadresu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavati uttama slokir bhaktir bhavati naistiki Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya
Hare Krishna Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Okay, so we're on Canto 4, Chapter 28. Paranjan becomes a woman in the next life. And it's text 28. Tam
Eva
Manasa
Grinan
Babuva
Pramodatam
Pramodatama Pramodotama
Anantaram
Vidarbhasya
Raja
Singhasya
Vaishmani
Tameva Manasa
Grinan
Babuva Pramadotama
Anantaram Vidarbhasya
Raja Singhasya
Vaishmani
Tameva Manasa
Grinan
Babuva Pramadotama
Anantaram Vidarbhasya
Raja Singhasya
Vaishmani
Anantaram Vidarbhasya
Rajo Singhasya Vishmani. Tameva Manasa Grinam. Bahuva Pramadottama. Anantaram Vidarbhasya. Raja Singhasya Vishmani, ladies. Tameva Manasa Grinan. Babuva Pramadottama. Anantaram Vidarbhasya. Raja Singhasya Vishmani. Tameva Manasa Grinan. Babuva Pramadottama. Anantaram Vidarbhasya. Raja Singhasya Vishmani. Tameva Manasa Grinan. Babuva Pramadottama. Anantaram Vidarbhasya. Raja Singhasya Vishmani. Girls, Sita. Tameva Manasa Grinan. Babuva Pramadottama. Anantaram Vidarbhasya. Raja Singhasya Vishmani. Tameva Manasa Grinan. Babuva Pramadottama. Anantaram Vidarbhasya. Raja Singhasya Vishmani. Tam. Eva, certainly, Manasa, by the mind, Grinan, accepting, Babuva, became, Pramada, woman, Uttama, highly situated, Anantaram, after death, Vidarbhasya, of Vidarbha, Raja Singhasya, of the most powerful king, Vaishmani, at the house. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. King Paranjan gave up his body while remembering his wife, and consequently in his next life, he became a very beautiful and well-situated woman. He took his next birth as the daughter of King Vidarbha in the very house of the king. Please repeat. King Paranjan gave up his body.
King Paranjan gave up his body.
While remembering his wife.
While remembering his wife.
And consequently. In his next life. He became a very beautiful and well-situated woman. He took his next birth. As the daughter of King Vidarbha. In the very house of the king. Purport. Since King Paranjan thought of his wife at the time of death, he attained the body of a woman in his next birth. This verifies the following verse in the Bhagavad Gita 8.6. Yam yam varpi smaram bhavam chajante kalevaram. Tam tam evaiti konteya sadatat bhava bhavitaha. Whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, that stage he will attain without fail. When a living entity is accustomed to think of a particular subject matter, or become absorbed in a certain type of thought, he will think of that subject at the time of death. At the time of death, one will think of the subject that has occupied his life while he was awake, lightly sleeping or dreaming, or while he was deeply sleeping. After falling from the association of the Supreme Lord, the living entity thus transmigrates from one bodily form to another according to nature's course, until he finally attains the human form. If he is absorbed in material thoughts and ignorant of spiritual life, and if he does not take shelter under the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Govinda, who solves all questions of birth and death, he will become a woman in the next life, especially if he thinks of his wife. As stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam 3.31.1, Kamana Daiva Netrena, a living entity acts piously and impiously, and sometimes in both ways. All actions are taken into account, and the living entity is offered a new body by his superiors. Although King Paranjan was overly attached to his wife, he nonetheless performed many pious fruitive activities. Consequently, although he took the form of a woman, he was given a chance to be the daughter of a powerful king. As is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita 6.41, Prapya Punya Kritam Lokan Ushitva Shashvati Sama Suchinam Srimatam Gehe Yogo Brasto Bijayate. The unsuccessful yogi, after many, many years of enjoyment on the planets of the pious living entities, is born into a family of righteous people or into a family of rich aristocracy. If a person falls from the path of bhakti yoga, God realization, due to attachment to fruitive activity, philosophical speculation, or mystic yoga, he is given a chance to take birth in a high and rich family. The higher authorities appointed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead thus render justice to the living entity according to the living entity's desires. Although King Paranjan was overly absorbed in thoughts of his wife and thus became a woman, he took birth in the family of a king due to his previous pious activities. The conclusion is that all of our activities are taken into consideration before we are awarded another body. Narada Muni therefore advised Vyasadeva that one should take to Krishna consciousness, devotional service, and abandon all ordinary occupational duties. This advice was also given by Lord Krishna himself. Although a devotee may fall from the path of spiritual consciousness, he will nonetheless attain a human body in the home of a devotee or a rich man. In this way, one can resume his devotional service. King Paranjan gave up his body while remembering his wife, and consequently in his next life, he became a very beautiful and well-situated woman. He took his next birth as the daughter of King Vidarbha, in the very house of the king. So, all of our actions are taken into account, and we are offered a new body by our superiors. So this is the science of living in the material world. We see so much effort on the part of modern educated men to try to understand scientifically what this world is, what the cause is, where we are from, like this, and what the progress of life is. So they're inspecting the material nature by so many different means, and they're very proud of their advancement in inventing different kinds of machines for going deeper and deeper into the structure of material existence. And ultimately, they're looking for the spark of life. Yeah, whatever it is that's animating this world, they're trying to find that out. Yesterday, I was giving class to the Russian devotees, and we talked a little bit about this large Hadron Collider that they built in Switzerland, where they're trying to smash atoms and split them so that they can go further and deeper into their understanding of what material nature is. And what they're looking for is what they call the God particle, euphemistically, of course. It's been nicknamed the God particle, the Higgs boson. Basically, what that means is that If you don't accept that there's consciousness behind matter and supporting it, then you have to have another explanation of what matter is and how it came into being. If you don't accept that it was created by an original living being, an original consciousness, then you have to explain how it suddenly came into being on its own, how this material world or matter became self-manifest. And if you try to subordinate the principle of consciousness to the mechanical movements of chemicals, you have to have an explanation of where those chemicals came from and how they manifest and how they began to move and why they would combine together in order to produce what we call life. So in this way then, by inspecting material nature, finer and finer degrees, you know, the molecule, then the atoms, and then the protons and the neutrons, and now they're getting into particle physics, boson, and different descriptions are there, observing nature and seeing how it's working, how it's moving. Because working means movement. Ultimately, it's the movement of everything that we're interested in. What makes everything move? What animates it? Yeah. The spark of life. That's what we're looking for. So their idea is that if there's no God, then there has to be an alternative explanation how everything came into being. And of course that leads to some quite ludicrous proposals. The main one of which is that everything literally comes from nothing. Yeah? Because if you say that it has a source, you have to identify the source. If you say there is no source, then you have to prove how things came into existence. So their only alternative that if everything didn't come from something, it must have come from nothing. You see how ludicrous this kind of thinking, the state of mind that it puts you into, that then you actually try to prove that everything that we see, this vast universe, immeasurable, inconceivable, how it all originated from nothing. Literally nothing. That's the proposal. And they have so many mathematicians trying to prove that, and so many physicists, you know, expanding on that idea that there was literally nothing, and then there was something. And it's what they call a point of singularity, that there must have been an original something that started. Of course, if you say there was an original something, that's not quite correct, because that implies that it was always there. And their theory is that there was nothing that was there at the beginning. Yeah, there's no eternality, if you like. But things must have started. So how can they start? So their idea is to prove that things started literally from nothing. Because if you say that the alternative, that things started from something, then what is that something? And then you're back to God again. So to eliminate God, you have to prove that everything started from nothing. Which is a ludicrous proposal. How can you have nothing and then suddenly something? But they're trying to explain that. One of the explanations is that there was literally nothing and then something, and that something had no mass. And therefore it is almost infinitesimally small. A point of singularity. Yeah, something that explaining that the universe was smaller than the full stop in the sentence, at the end of a sentence in the book. Yeah. And then somehow or another, it expanded into what we call the universe now. And so how did it expand? It gained mass, substance of some kind or another. That literally from nothing, something came. That something then has to have something. Substance. Nothing has no substance. And then it has to go from having no substance to having substance, or from no mass to having mass. So how does that work? So the theory was put out in the 1960s by this gentleman, Mr. Higgs, that there's a mechanism. There has to be some kind of a mechanism from going from a state of no mass to a state of mass, and then seeing what we have all around us. So his proposal was that there was some kind of hidden field of some kind or another, maybe magnetic or electromagnetic or something, but it's not something that you can see. It's not something that you can measure. It has no tangible existence. But it must be there because things did actually gain mass. So there must be evidence of that field. And the evidence will lie in the smallest particles, original particles that form the universe, and they're called bosons. So their idea was that we should see some evidence that you can't measure this field, the Higgs field, it's not possible, but you should see some inference of it in its product. From looking at the effects, then you can trace back the cause. So his proposal is that there's some mechanism which gives mass to what we call the stuff of the universe. It goes from a state of having no mass, in which point, you know, this point of singularity, into becoming or being imbued with mass and then expanding as we see the universes today. So his idea was that there was some kind of invisible field, yeah, something unknown. And that gave rise, somehow or another, to the particles of mass. And there should therefore be some evidence in the mass that we observe, in the particles of matter that we observe. But nobody's ever seen it. So therefore, they spent $10 billion building a machine, some 18 miles in circumference or something, whatever it is, very big. It's called the Large Hadron Collider. And what it's designed to do is to smash atoms, because in the atoms themselves, we can't find the answer. Because within an atom, which was once considered to be the smallest particle, they found that there are other particles, neutrons and protons and these things, and they're whizzing around within the atom and making the atoms move. So what's making the protons and neutrons move? What's making them whiz around? So in like this, you go back, trying to find the original cause. So his idea is that there's an original invisible cause, and if we find evidence of its existence, that would help to prove the theory that things can go from a state of having no mass to a state of having mass. And then the universe can be actually proved to be self-manifest without the need of a god. So it's a little complex, but that's the general understanding. So they've been smashing atoms for the last few years. And this last summer, they actually got very excited because they thought that they'd finally found some evidence of what they call the Higgs boson, the Higgs particle. So a little glimmer of it, or a hint of it. And then they're proclaiming, now, yes, we're successful. But when you actually read the literature, it's still, they're saying that it may be. We think we've seen it. There's a hint of it somewhere or another. If it's actually there, then that means this will happen and that will happen, etc., etc. So they're still guessing. And even though they've spent so much time and effort and money and so much brain power into figuring out what makes the universe move, yeah, what that invisible field might be, still they're actually not getting anywhere near it. They have no actual proof of their theories. And they'll go on like this, examining material nature for billions of years, but they'll never actually find out what it is and what makes it move, because they're not looking in the right place. They're looking at matter. They're looking at the mechanisms and constructs of matter. But whilst agreeing that there's some force, invisible force, that is moving matter, they will not come to the proposition that that force is consciousness. That it's the soul, what we call the soul, or the atma, or consciousness, or that something which is symptomized by consciousness, personality. Consciousness means personality. They won't come to that point because it means then having to accept that there's some superior being to themselves. This is what it gets down to. I read an interview with this particle physicist, and he was getting all excited about the Higgs mechanism and the Higgs field and the Higgs boson. And the reporter asked him, well, what's ultimately the purpose of all of this investigation anyway? And he said, so that we can manipulate matter. That's it, in one sentence. We can manipulate matter. In other words, there's no God who's manipulating matter. We shall manipulate matter. We've just got to prove it, that's all. You know, come up with a theory. And if we can figure out how everything is actually strung together, you know, how everything is connected, and the underlying principle behind it, we've got the key for manipulating matter, and then we will be God. Simple. So somebody has to be in a superior position. Of course, the fact that he makes that comment is indicative of the reality, which he's ignoring. He says that so that we can manipulate matter. That means that that we is superior to matter. You figure out how matter is actually, you know, integrated. You figure out the principle of it, what they call the unified field. And then you manipulate it. So if you can manipulate something, it means you are superior. Yeah. So indirectly, this man is saying consciousness is superior to matter. And yet at the same time, they still insist that no, matter is a consciousness is a product of matter. It's an effect. And when matter decombines, then what we call consciousness or life simply disappears. But at the same time, he's saying, no, we want to manipulate matter. That means that we is conscious. Yeah? It's not some unconscious living being that's saying that. It's not unconscious beings that are doing all of this endeavor, spending so much money and building all these machines. They are conscious, and they are manipulating matter to investigate it and penetrate it so that they can manipulate it even more. So consciousness is actually supreme. It is superior to matter, no matter which way you look at it. Either you accept directly that God exists and that he has other living beings that work on his behalf, as it's mentioned here, by some superiors. Each living being is moved from one material situation to another by superior living beings. Yeah. So either you accept that, which is the science of the Bhagavatam, or you go for the other so-called science, yeah, where you're not admitting that this consciousness is superior, and at the same time you're saying that you want to manipulate matter because you're a conscious living being, which is contradictory. So it's a conundrum, and they're never going to solve it, because they won't accept that consciousness is original. No, everything comes from nothing. Doesn't come from some original source. But when you look at this material universe, how you can say that there was literally nothing and then something? Just by ordinary logic, how you can have nothing and then something? Where does the something come from? It must have always been there. You can't avoid this fact that everything is eternal. You can't avoid it. Either materially or spiritually, everything is eternal. That's the first point. And then, if you accept that everything is eternal, that means that consciousness has always been there. Yeah. That never proved at any point that there was some progression of matter and combinations of matter, which then, at a certain point, gave rise to life. As far as anybody knows, life has always been there as long as matter has been combining. That's a fact. Yeah, nobody can say otherwise. Matter, if you accept that matter is eternal, then everything associated with matter is also eternal. It's always been there. There's no beginning and there's no end. So you can't get away from the fact that everything is eternal. Either the material nature itself or the consciousness that pervades this universe. Everything is always there. That means that when you look back for a cause, then how far you look back, more and more and more, there's always one cause behind, another cause behind. Whatever you see is an effect. And there's ultimately always another cause behind it, until you get to this supreme cause, Krishna, the supreme conscious living being. All other living beings, of course, if we accept that consciousness is eternal, it doesn't mean that it's superior. That's the point that's being made here. It's not superior, because still we find that we are subjected to conditions of living that we don't want. And we're trying to escape it. Birth, death, disease, and old age. Especially this business of dying. Yeah, and then, you know, what happens after that? It's not immediately visible to us. So we have to accept, you know, that we are inferior in some respects to what? Now, if we're superior to matter, consciousness is superior to matter, then at the same time we're conscious and we're being inflicted, or we're being forced to accept conditions of life that we don't want. That means there's something else that is superior to us. And what that is a supreme consciousness. It can't be anything less. Something that is not conscious cannot exert itself on something which is conscious. Consciousness is a symptom of movement, life. We don't see in dead chemicals anything. But when there's a principle of life added, then you see movement. When the principle of life is removed, then you see collapse, breakdown. So matter cannot be superior to consciousness. But consciousness itself, at least in terms of our consciousness, individual consciousness, is also not supreme. So what is superior to us means a bigger consciousness. That's all. So by logic, you can come to the point of understanding that there is ultimately a supreme conscious living being who is directing the wanderings of all other living beings, whether in this universe or out of it. This is the science of the Bhagavatam. It's the science of studying consciousness and the nature of consciousness. So material scientists, they're looking just at the mechanics of this material world, but actually when you discuss with them what the nature of consciousness is, they haven't got a clue. Although they claim that consciousness is being produced by chemical combinations, look around. There's billions and billions of living beings that are appearing at every moment in material nature, from the microscopic to the macroscopic. At every second, every split second, some living being or another is making its appearance. Yeah. Some spark of consciousness is making, you know, its presence felt. So, given that life is occurring so many times, in so many different ways, through so many different combinations of chemicals, surely you should by now have been able to prove, at least give one instance, where chemicals have actually combined and given life. It's all around us. It's going on. But they can't do that. You ask any scientist if you can prove completely and absolutely that life comes from a combination of chemicals and show it. Yeah, get the chemicals, combine them together and produce life from it. They can't do it. When you actually ask them for proof, they cannot provide it. It's just a theory, that's all. So they have their theory and we have ours. They have their so-called science. Their science, we're led to believe, is real knowledge, fact. But it's not. It's all theory. It's just based on different speculations, and then they set out to prove them. And if they observe something in matter that doesn't fit with their speculation, they'll then just push that to one side. Instead of basing their understandings on what they actually observe, they're trying to observe what their understanding is. They have an understanding to begin with, a prejudice, and then they try to observe it in material nature. That's what the Higgs boson is all about. Yeah. They have a preset idea, and now they want to try to prove it. Instead of observing everything as it is, and then drawing a conclusion from what they observe, they're doing it back to front. That's not science. It's not knowledge. It's simply speculation. And therefore, Prabhupada, practically every day of his preaching life, was protesting against this false information and against this cheating, as you said, of the scientists. And it is cheating to present something as a fact when you know very well it's not, that it's not been proven. But still they'll insist. So here, at least anyway, in the Bhagavatam, we're given the real science of what's going on in this material world. That consciousness is actually different from matter. Parayam vittastunyam prakritim vidime param. Yeah, that prakriti is param. It's superior to matter. And all the movements of matter are resting on the presence of those particles of superior energy, what we call the soul or the atma. Yeah. This whole universe, the atoms, the protons, the molecules, the planets, you know, big or small, the movement is there because of the presence of conscious living beings, a superior kind of energy. So Mr. Higgs is looking for this invisible field. Here it is. In one sense, they're saying, yes, they're looking for the God particle. So here it is. It's explained in the Bhagavatam. That invisible field is the soul. Yeah, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that some look upon the soul as amazing. Some hear about the soul as amazing. Some people can't, just even after hearing, can't understand him at all. Because it's amazing. Yeah, it's not conceivable. It's inconceivable. What it is that makes everything move, you know, causes all the interactions of matter. It's inconceivable. And by inference, we can understand it, therefore. Yeah, we can't show you the soul, but we are the soul. And by the, you know, effects of the soul's activities, you can understand the presence and nature of the soul. Therefore, Krishna gives this simple explanation, scientific explanation, at the very beginning, that the body is always changing, but the occupant of the body remains the same. It's a scientific explanation that the constructs of matter are not permanent, but the thing on which the constructs of matter rest is. It's constant and steady. And just as we observe in this one lifetime that the body is always changing every second, every minute, every hour, every day, but yet the consciousness, the living being who is experiencing that change remains the same living being, the same identity, I. So it's a simple but scientific proposal that there's a difference between life and matter. And life is superior. And just as we see that the life does not die off with the shedding of a young body to, you know, an adult body to an old body, but remains constant. In the same way, why should we assume that when the body collapses and falls down, that spark of life that was animating it all the way through suddenly disappears into nothingness? Why would it do that? Why would something become nothing? The other side of the argument, how can nothing become something? So in the same way, you can argue the other way, back to front, that something cannot become nothing. The fact is that there is no nothing. There is something, and there has always been something, and there will always be something, just because of the fact that we see it right now. Whatever exists has always existed and will always continue to exist. It existed in the past, it will exist in the so-called future. Existence is substance. So consciousness is substantial. It animates the entire universe. And beyond that, small, tiny, individual consciousnesses that we are, there is a superior force which is acting, which is a supreme consciousness, and that is also eternal. Not that, but he. Because we're also, as conscious living beings, we're personalities. We have thinking, feeling, and willing. We have activities, we have senses, we have perception. So why should we assume that God has none of those things, that superior consciousness as none of those attributes that we have? Then what would make him superior? If God cannot think, feel, and will, if God doesn't have senses, if God does not have activities, then how is he superior to the ordinary living beings that do? Therefore, this Mayavad concept is also bogus. Atheism. It's also a misunderstanding of the true nature of what life actually is. So the Bhagavatam is presenting us with a clear picture of life. It's eternal, it's inconceivable, It's indescribable, but it's there. So these principles, even in science, have to be accepted. The eternality of something, the inconceivability of something. You have to accept these principles. You can't get away from them if you're honest. So as much as they like to try to cheat us, you know, by this bogus idea of something coming from nothing, it's not possible. It's not provable because it's not a fact. Fact is that we do exist and we've always existed. Now, how we exist, yeah, why we're in this material world, yeah, even though we're eternal, why do we have to suffer, you know, this acceptance of temporary conditions and then the consequent, you know, upsetting or disturbance when we have to give those circumstances up, that we have to look at. That's real science. Understanding what life is, why we're here, where we're going, what happens after death, why we had to take birth in this particular situation, in this particular form. This is real science. Yeah. This is the science of consciousness. So the Bhagavatam presents a superior science to anything prevalent in the current scientific field. And that's why Prabhupada wanted us to present the Bhagavatam in the temple of the Vedic Planetarium. He wanted us to present this world view of a conscious universe, a living universe, a universe based on or with an underlying field of life. Yeah, not electromagnetic impulses, but an underlying unifying field that is called life. That's all. It's an affirmation of life. So this is the Vedic viewpoint. This is the Vedic worldview. It's opposite to, in some senses, what the scientists are trying to convince us of. But ultimately, when you get down into their arguments, they're talking about the same thing. All the same elements are there. It's just that they have a prejudice against the idea that there could be any living being superior to themselves. We want to manipulate matter. That's their whole endeavor. And yet they can't see that they are being continually manipulated themselves. The same man that's saying we will manipulate matter is himself growing old, getting disease, and being booted out of his so-called body and placed into another one. Because they don't know that science. They don't know that every action has a reaction. Or they, at least they can say that scientifically, every action has a reaction. But that's true for consciousness also. Every action that a conscious living being does, he's held to account for. Either good or so-called good or so-called bad. Yeah, there's no free lunches, as they say. You have to pay for everything. Whatever we do, that's counted by superiors. And then at the end of this, you know, time that we have to spend in this body, we have to move on. Everything that we've done, every little thing, big or small, is taken into account, and then we're placed into another body. And then we experience another round of material activities. And it's endless. It's going on. So the point about this is to give us an understanding that there is a superior force in the universe. We are being pushed along by that force, unwillingly or unwillingly. And we can never be God. We can never be God. But we can be friendly with God. Instead of being pushed along by force, devotional life means the science of being guided, you know, by this superior consciousness in a positive way, in a friendly way, in order to achieve the goal of life, which is to become happy. Because all of this, ultimately, why would you want to manipulate matter? So that you can become happy. Right? Otherwise, why bother? You're simply manipulating, getting control of material nature. Why do you want to control material nature? Because you want to be happy. Happiness is the meaning of life. But you'll never do it through mechanisms, manipulation of mechanisms. We gain happiness from linking up with that superior consciousness. Instead of that superior consciousness acting on us in a seemingly impersonal way, pushing us from one body to another, to another, to another, to another. What's the alternative? The alternative is to understand who that supreme living being, that supreme consciousness is, and what does he want? And then agree to comply with that. Put oneself in a situation where we favorably cooperate with that supreme consciousness. And then see what happens. And that's the proposal that's been given in the Bhagavatam. That instead of being trapped in this endless cycle of repeated birth and death, link up with that supreme consciousness in a favorable way. And then he will draw you back to his original abode, where there is no birth, death, disease, and old age. Vaikuntha. This material universe is Kunta, full of anxiety because of these changes. You go back to Krishna, you go back and link up with that supreme consciousness, no more Kunta, Vaikuntha. Then there's only bliss, because all of your activities are going on in an endless flow of ecstasy. That's the science of the Bhagavatam. That's the proposition that's been given here. Okay, so we'll finish there. Anybody have any comments or questions? Prana Prabhu. How are you?
Hare Krishna. This point of singularity, it's also there in the Srimad Bhagavatam, because the universe comes out as a point, an egg, golden egg, and then it expands, the mass expands and it becomes the universe.
Yes.
So it's there in the Bhagavatam.
Yes. And it means that it always has what they call mass, substance. Yeah. You know, it's identifiable. To avoid having, you know, an explanation which includes God, you've got to have a universe which literally comes from nothing. But since the universe has substance or mass, you have to explain where that comes from if it all came from nothing. That they can't do. But yes, you're right. In the Bhagavatam, that science is there. It does come. The universes do come from a very, very small infinitesimal point from the pores of the skin of Lord Mahavishnu. And then they begin to expand. And then they have a duration. And then they have a contraction. And then they're sucked back into the body of the Lord again. But the Lord himself is the cause of all of that. And that's what they don't see, or rather that's what they don't want to see. They're only seeing what they want to see. They're not seeing anything else. And therefore Krishna says, you'll never see me. Because you don't want to see me, therefore you never will see me. I draw that curtain of Maya or illusion over your eyes. Even if you're a big physicist or scientist, so-called scientist, very intelligent person, you'll never see anything. Yeah, Maya Parita Jnana. Yeah, those who are very intelligent, oh, they have so much credit, writing so many theories, building so many wonderful, you know, computers and atom smashers and, you know, spaceships and whatever it is. But foolish, illusioned, not knowing what the real truth of existence actually is. So the Bhagavatam gives us a complete explanation. And therefore Prabhupada insisted right from the very beginning. You see, all the time that he was preaching, he repeatedly refers to the science of Godhead. He uses that word very deliberately because it is a science. Not that, you know, because, oh, now science has become the call of the day, you know, for the last 150 years. Now we're not sentimentalists, we're scientists. And therefore Prabhupada's just trying to co-opt, you know, a term that people respect so that he can explain the philosophy of the Bhagavatam. He's not. He's actually talking about real science. This is an explanation of life and the universe and everything. And it's as valid, it's more valid than what is being presented to us as the scientific explanation. But Prabhupada was able to break down, you know, all these arguments that they're presenting and expose them. He was on a morning walk in December of 1975 in Vrindavan, and one of the devotees, Alanath, he was just visiting from Sweden, he mentioned that the Swedish devotees were producing a magazine which would be aimed at, you know, exposing the scientists. So Prabhupada immediately checked him. He said, don't do it unless you can do it expertly. He said, otherwise you'll look foolish. Because these people are very tricky and they're very expert in what they present. So unless you can actually explain it in a very, you know, scientific way, then you'll look foolish. But he said, I can do it because I am convinced that you cannot create the soul from matter. Therefore, Prabhupada was able to meet with many scientists, educationalists, philosophers. They could never get past his arguments. Within 5 minutes of talking to them, Prabhupada would expose the limitations of their own ideas and then come right in with the science of the Bhagavatam. Why? On that one point, that he was convinced you cannot create a soul from matter. You cannot create consciousness from matter. And on that one scientific point, he was able to, you know, expose all the defects of modern scientists. And Prabhupada was fearless because he actually knew the truth. That's the point. Yeah, he was situated on a platform of realization. The scientists are not. They're not situated on a platform of realization, making something real. They're situated on a platform of mental speculation. One idea after another pops into their crazy brains. You know, they come out with all these different theories, none of which they've been able to prove. And yet, here we are, living beings. We do exist. We're not illusory. We do exist. Consciousness actually exists. It's a reality. So Prabhupada had a full realization of his own position as a living being and the supreme living being. And therefore he was very, very effective in, you know, exposing the defects which bewilder practically everybody else. You know, people, everywhere all over the world, people are completely bewildered by this whole idea of scientific investigation and experimentation and explanation. They don't even question it because it seems so, you know, esoteric. You know, you get into quantum physics and, you know, the square root of minus one or whatever it is they start with. I don't know, you're an educationalist. I mean, they come out with all kinds of propositions. Why, an ordinary man, they just don't even bother to try and think about it because it sounds so fantastic and complex. But Prabhupada could just come in with one point and kill them. Yeah, there's a martial arts system where just by hitting this one point, you just touch it and the person dies. Prabhupada said, I know that art. Just that one point, when I touch it, finished. That's material science. So yes, you're right. It's there in the Bhagavatam. Point of singularity. Any other questions or comments? Yeah.
This Newton's first law, which says energy can neither be created nor be destroyed. So, in effect, science does accept the eternality of energy. But the problem with them is that they discount the energetic. They don't see the energetic behind the energy.
Yes.
They just see the energy, that's all. And then they try to manipulate everything based on that law. But the eternality of energy, science do accept. But energetic, they're not able to see. That's the problem with
that. That's a fact. And therefore you have this proposal, you know, this Higgs mechanism, Higgs field, Higgs boson. If you can discover the boson, it would be indicative of the field. And if the field then is existing somewhere or another, they think that may give them the clue on, you know, understanding what everything is resting upon, as you say, the energetic. So they're trying to understand the energy and then try to go back to the energetic. But the energetic is non-material, that's the problem. But they don't accept the proposition that something can be non-material. Or at least, you know, generally they don't. There's been some speculations also about that. But ultimately, you know, consciousness is a mystery. They can't understand it no matter which way they look at it, because it can't be understood by an inductive method. And that's the point that Prabhupada always made, that they're trying to, you know, I mean, a deductive method. They're trying to deduce what's going on by observing, you know, the movements of matter by inference. But actually the only way that you can understand consciousness and the Supreme Consciousness is by inductive method, by being told, by having it revealed to you. Yeah. So they're not qualified for that system. Therefore they'll go on speculating and speculating. They'll never find out that energetic source. Okay, we'll finish there. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
I started Tai Chi 5 years ago, but it's a special master for me. sit in the headstand in the Shirshasana and Shavasana. So then you put the energy more to the hips and to the back. So I do this here, there's one point of the Shavasana and Shirshasana. This is the most, these are the kings of the asana, I would say. The king of the asana is Shirshasana and the headstand. Shavasana is compared very nice to you know, because I have sometimes here very skin problems because of the food and the klima. It's changed so quick every day. Sometimes when the temperature goes down, then it's going to hurt again. Because you push it more than right was dry klima, like you push. And I take homeopathy medicine here, because the same as you have always used the red stripes inside, you know, chemtrails. You know what chemtrails are? Chemtrails is based on chemical trails that we used in the 1980s in the Russia as a project. And they use it for making it better or bad weather. Like they can make it better or they want. So right now they use this kind of thing for American sun since the
Thank you. Thank you. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krish Krishna.